Welcome. I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. There are nearly a quarter million Muslims living in the Bay Area, and half of those are under the age of 35. A recent panel convened by New America Media to spotlight the voices of these young Muslims brought speakers together from all over the Bay Area and from many different backgrounds, ethnicities, nationalities. They spoke about some of the highlights and challenges of defining a Muslim identity in the U.S. for young people. One of today's guests, Abbas Darab, told the audience, "In high school, I was searching and looking to find myself because I'm Afghan and I'm Muslim and I'm American. And are those contradictory?" He's not alone in asking this question, given our country's great history with extreme Islamophobia. According to a recent survey by the Bay Area Muslim Study of more than 1,100 Bay Area Muslims, 60% of respondents said they had experienced Islamophobia at some point. Another survey of 500 Muslim young people in California showed that most, about 80%, said their experience being Muslim in public schools was positive. But the survey also showed there were some persistent problems. For instance, 5% of those surveyed said their teachers did not respect their religion. 10% reported being physically bullied, including being slapped, kicked, or punched. 17% of girls who wore the hijab, the Islamic headscarf, reported being mistreated because of their choice in clothing. Half of the survey respondents said they'd been subject to mean comments or rumors as a result of their faith. But some things are changing. Berkeley is actually home to the first Muslim liberal arts college in the United States, called Zaytuna College in Berkeley, California, which will be graduating its first class of students this May. One of today's guests, Daoud Yassin, works at Zaytuna. He also spoke at the New America Media panel and said separating culture from religion is of the utmost importance for this generation. Being here in the U.S. creates an incredible opportunity for these things not to happen here. So today we're going to continue this conversation with some of those same panelists on the New America Media panel. Joining us today is Daoud Yassin, Director of Student Life at Zaytuna College in Berkeley, the first four-year Muslim liberal arts college in the United States, which will be graduating its first class in May. Prior to Zaytuna, Daoud worked as the Muslim Life and Services Trips Coordinator at Dartmouth, where he provided spiritual and religious support and led congregational prayers for Muslim students there. And Daoud joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anna, and good morning to everyone.
Good morning. With us also is Abbas Darab. He is in his third year at Zaytuna College in Berkeley. He says his passion is community and social activism. He's pursuing the path of Islamic scholarship and intends to continue his studies after Zaytuna abroad. He hopes to bridge Islamic scholarship with social justice and community activism, grassroots building. And as a native of Afghanistan, where his family is from Afghanistan, he hopes to aid in the rebuilding of the country through establishing legitimate educational institutions and connecting the Afghan community abroad with Afghans here in the United States. And welcome to the show, Abbas.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to join you guys.
Thank you. And also with us is Ilham Awad. She is a Sudanese-American Muslim organizer at San Francisco State. She is graduating with a degree. Her major is international relations with a minor in French. She joins me in studio. Welcome to the show, Ilham.
Thanks, Hannah. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much. So I guess My first question to you all, and also I want to open this up to the audience, definitely, for any questions you have to our panel. The number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Or you can shoot us an email with your question or comment at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Firstly, when we talk about Muslims, non-Muslim people, people in our audience in mainstream America might think that Muslim equals Arab. But there are a quarter million Muslims in the Bay Area and a third half South Asian roots, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan. Less than a quarter are actually Arab. There are Muslims from Ethiopia and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Sudan and Egypt and India, and the countries just go on and on. So do each of you feel that being Muslim is something that unites all these people from different countries who now live in California? And do you have to deal with that that notion that, oh, you're a Muslim, then you're Arab? Abbas, why don't you start?
Yeah, that's a really common misconception, I think, amongst non-Muslims, but Muslims as well. Because I know myself growing up, the Prophet, peace be upon him, he was Arab and from Arab descent. And, you know, Islam started in an Arab environment and then quickly spread from there. So it's very easy to understand how that misconception can arise. I think a lot of Muslims a lot of times equate Arab culture with Islam as well. That's a misconception amongst Muslims also. But I think if you look at Islamic history, right from the beginning, the Prophet, peace be upon him, he was surrounded by people from all different backgrounds, and his companions were very diverse in their and where they came from and their ethnicities as well. So it's from the beginning, from the origins of Islam that, you know, there are people from different backgrounds. But as the faith, within 100 years, you see Islam spreading from the east to the west, from Spain to China. And so just from a historical standpoint, you see that Islam is not limited only to the Arab ethnicity whatsoever. And then as far as the day goes, myself being here for the past 3 years, it's been I think this specific Bay Area community is very special in that you really have, as the survey that my teacher, Dr. Hatem, and Dr. Fayed Zanzai both put together, that you see the statistics and, the Arab ethnicity is not only, is it not the majority, but it's one of the minority ethnicities, which is shocking to many people. And you see other communities that you wouldn't immediately assume to be a Muslim, to be one of the, even a greater population size than the Arab community. And so in this Bay Area community, it's very unique in that we have people from many different backgrounds, because there are certain communities that are more ethnically centered in one direction, whereas here in the Bay Area, we have a very diverse culture,
right,
and ethnical background. So it's really, and all of that comes together. For example, there's a masjid, a local mosque in the area called Lighthouse Mosque, which was founded by one of my teachers. And if you go there, you literally see people from all different backgrounds, and the only reason that they're in that mosque is simply their basic unity in the religion. So it's a really beautiful thing to experience.
Thank you. And Dawood, do you want to pick up on that idea of, of Muslims as, kind of this monolithic group? Just this panel, you're African American. Ilham here is Sudanese American. Abbas on the phone is Afghani American. So you want to touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was traveling with two colleagues back when I was in New Hampshire at Dartmouth, and we were driving to Ohio, so we had a lot of time to talk. And one of them asked me a question, saying, is Islam monolithic? And I almost blurted out, of course it is, because I was thinking he said monotheistic, because anyone that would look at Islam would understand that, 1.6 billion people, it would be very difficult to have a monolithic representation, understanding, and application of Islam. So I think, and we could just kind of extrapolate that idea onto other, groups of people when we're talking about this idea of being monolithic. So I think that's something that perhaps is a persuasion that is caused by media representation. I think about, Islam in Indonesia, let's just say hypothetically, the most populous Muslim country, in the world. What do we hear about Indonesia? What do we know about Indonesian, their culture with regard to Islam? Obviously, I'm talking about globally, but then just to hear, for example, even we'll talk about, African Americans and the history of Islam in this country, you know, Dr. Sylvia Diouf in her book, Servants of Allah, African Muslims Enslaved in the Americas, she's saying from 25% to 25% of African slaves that were brought over to the Americas were Muslim. And then why I mention that is because in this kind of post-11 discourse that we have on Islam in America, I really feel that that's a voice that's been absent from the discussion.
Post-9/11?
Yeah, which is going to give an entirely different perspective of what Islam in America kind of looks like in practice. And in you know so in function, and it being familiar to a lot of people. So
at the end of last year, the California chapter of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, did this study on how Muslim students were doing in school, and it was mostly positive, but there were still issues like bullying from other kids, as we mentioned, teachers, they said, not respecting their faith. For you growing up here and after, you know, in this 9/11 atmosphere as well, Ilham, you're kind of the most recent high schooler or person who's been in school, I guess, on the panel. Tell me about your experiences at school, and have you felt any of this discrimination, the bullying, any of that because of your faith?
I think that to a degree I have experienced it because, you know, I guess on the exterior, people already have an idea of what a Muslim even looks like aesthetically. And so when they see me and then they find out that I'm Muslim, if we're in a conversation or in a certain context, people are shocked and they're like, oh, well, then all the stereotypes that they have start to come
into
play.
Well, why? Because we're on radio, people can't see you. So what do you mean by that?
I mean, you know, because I don't wear a headscarf. And I mean, I don't know. I do things that I think Muslims do all over the world, but people don't assume that, because I think the problem is that people want to politicize Islam. And that comes from, you know, foreign policy in the U.S. It comes from the post 9/11 era. Definitely people see Arab, they see the Middle East, they see terrorism, they see Islam. So they want to connect all these things and exclude, you know, the reality that is Islam for many people.
And how did that affect you in school?
And that affected me because I found myself having to defend Islam and to engage in these discussions a lot more than I did before. And because I was a kid when, I remember, I think I was in fourth or fifth grade when 9/11, you know, when that happened. And just a week later, you know what I mean? Just a week later, already in school, everybody started calling each other different things. And my sister, one of my sisters, her name is Ladin. And that's a beautiful name, you know? And it has nothing to do with Osama bin Laden, but people started calling her, like, names and stuff like that. And it's like she never experienced that before. And then all of a sudden something happens and it's a political issue. And all of a sudden even the younger generation starts to do that. But I think that I do... when I get a chance to engage in those discussions, and if I have to talk about Islam, I enjoy it because I know that people are getting this from, you know, misrepresentations in the media or, you know, in school. We learn really nothing about, you know, the beauty of Islamic society, you know, and the history, the strong history that there is in science and spirituality and art and everything. So it's a chance for me to engage and to say, you know what, let me challenge that. And I have my own personal experience to do that with. So I don't know. I like kind of throwing people off when they kind of assume what Muslim identity is. And they're like, oh, you're not you're Muslim. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? It's actually a faith. It's something I spiritually believe in. And it's my spiritual self. Hmm. But it doesn't have to be, you know, I don't know, my political identity
right.
or anything.
The email to send us a comment or a question for our panel is feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we do have an email from Benjamin, and he says, sorry for the basic question, but it would be helpful to understand, I think he's talking about Zaytuna College, is it just from a religious standpoint, like a Christian college, or is it a cultural thing, or both? So, Daoud Walid, can you explain to us, since this is really the first time this has happened in the U.S., you know, is Zaytuna College more like a seminary, or what is it? What is it exactly?
Yeah. So the concept at the college, it's a, so to short answer is no, it's not a seminary. And The co-founders are very intentional and ensuring that it was not a seminary, because seminary study can become quite insular. And the idea is that, you know, we want to engage, you know, our home, right? We want to engage the country where we're living currently. And so for that reason, the idea was to create a liberal arts college that is not excluding, you know, the religious, the Islamic tradition, intellectual tradition. So that's where the idea comes from, of creating a liberal arts college. And it's an idea that is not foreign to Islam. I mean, when you look at George Muqtasi's book, The Rise of Colleges, and you look at how, if you will, using modern kind of terms here, curriculum was developed, and the cohort system and other things such as this, this is not something that's foreign to Islam either. So, you know, basically it's taking a tradition which has already exists within the side of the Islamic tradition, taking the best of the liberal arts education from both traditions, and kind of putting them together. And so to kind of, you know, what we're looking at here are what Dorothy Sayers called, you know, acquiring the lost tools of learning. Right. So this is something that both within our, within the Islamic tradition and also within the Western tradition, looking at things. Right. So if you're talking about philosophy, looking at Western philosophers, but then also looking at what philosophy, you know, what did Imam Ghazali or other theologians and philosophers from the Islamic tradition, what were their contributions, and how do I understand that in the modern context? So that's kind of where we're at and what we're working on.
All right. And what, I know this is the first graduating class, but what do they become? What career paths are available for them?
Well, I think with any liberal arts college that, you know, they can become whatever they choose to become. I think that, you know, so for example, we have a very small graduating class, you know, relative small. We have 9 students graduating, 5 applied to graduate programs, and were accepted, and another 4 will begin work. But I think, you know, degrees in law, you know, great opportunity in discussing kind of a hot, you know, a buzzword right now of Sharia, you know, Islamic law and constitutional law. I think our students will be very well placed to begin work in that. But I think, you know, with anyone, there was an interesting quote, Andrew Del Banco in his book, What College Was, Is, and Should Be. He talks about a story of a young man who graduated from a liberal arts college and hadn't taken any classes in business administration but then found himself running a business. And you know, increased sales by 75% within 2 years. And so I really think this idea of, you know, critical thinking, the ability, adaptability, I'm really excited for our students not to be boxed in, mm-hmm. right? To say, you know, well, they can only be imams because they've gone to Zaytuna College, or they can only be chaplains if they're female, if for our female graduates. But really to say that, you know, it's yours to create. That's what I'm excited about.
Abbas, so we have you on for just a couple of minutes. You're in third year at Zaytuna. Let's ask you this question. What are your plans? What are you going to do with this education? You don't know
yet. What was that?
Go ahead, sorry.
I've been thinking about this question ever since I entered the college, and, you know, especially as a student coming into a new initiative like Zaytuna that didn't have accreditation yet at the time, we're still getting there. A lot of people ask that question, you know, like, what are you going to do with that education? How will you make money? And I really I wasn't sure exactly how to answer that question. All I knew was that my heart was set at Zaytuna, and that I felt that if I followed my passion would lead me to something that I could possibly benefit society while also, you know, making some type of income for myself. And so my first 2 years, I really didn't have a clear idea, but now towards my latter 2 years here at Zaytuna, I think a more of an idea has been shaping in my head for what I would like to pursue when I graduate from here. And generally, my general plan is that I would like to go and continue my studies of Islam traditionally. And as you mentioned in my introduction, that I'd like to go abroad and continue studying the Islamic sciences traditionally until I feel like I have a really good grounding. So perhaps a couple more years.
More studying for you then, Abbas. Before you leave, I know you have to leave really soon, but I really am interested in something you talked about in the panels, the New America Media panels, and you were talking about Muslim communities dealing with issues that have to do with marriage and gender issues, and those are areas that, as Muslims growing up here, you have ideas about and questions about. Can you briefly talk about that?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, as a new generation of Muslims growing up in this country, you know, there's a lot of issues and things that we had to deal with and face for the first time that our predecessors didn't face or didn't face in this manner. And our tradition really gives us the tools to grapple with those things in an appropriate manner. And so I highlighted two of those in the panel that I feel are very prevalent and ubiquitous issues amongst the Muslim community, those being, again, the relations and marriage. And the way I really map it out to justify that claim is that the way we go about our gender relations as a society in general, but specifically as a Muslim culture and as a Muslim society, that really impacts how our marriages are formed. The marriages are the basis of our families, and Islam has a huge emphasis, and society in general, on the family, because it's the building block of the community, and that the communities are the building blocks and parts of the greater community, which in Islam we call the Ummah, the nationwide community. And so really, the way we view our gender relations has this, you know, impactful consequence for the whole community. And so really, the way we go about that issue has intense consequences. And I was just talking about how we, as an American Muslim culture, are going to approach that issue, because every culture has their unique way of approaching certain issues, and Islam is wide enough to allow for that cultural leniency. And I was just pointing out that the way people do things in Saudi is not necessarily the way things need to be done in America, and that everything done in Saudi isn't resemblant of everything Islamic, and that could be an interpretation of Islam that certain people apply. And so I was just saying that we shouldn't limit ourselves to one narrow view of how things can be done, rather that Islam, it has the expansion within it to allow for different approaches,
right,
for different societies and different cultures.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Abbas, for joining us. That's Abbas Darab, third year Zaytuna College student, Zaytuna College in Berkeley. We will be right back with more after the break. This is Your Call.
Beyond the walls you live in, you make me, don't make me lose the faith.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation on the phone, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255. Or you can send your question via email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Nobody wanna try. I'm singing well. For those of you joining us now, I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow's our weekly media roundtable, where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. But today, what does it mean to grow up Muslim in the U.S.? Today, we're talking to Muslims about how they integrate their faith and beliefs within modern American culture. Nearly a quarter million Muslims live in the Bay Area, and half of them are under 35, and they deal with issues, gender issues, stereotyping, bullying since 9/11. So you can join the conversation as well at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255 if you have questions or comments. And really, we also want to ask you, how has faith played a role in your life, if at all, and how do you see Muslims around you? What have been your reactions when you see a Muslim on the street, in the store, someone who's visibly Muslim, or you might think they're Muslim? What feelings do you get? What questions do you have in your head? 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. You can send an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. With us is Daoud Yassin. He is Director of Student Life at Zaytuna College in Berkeley. And Zaytuna is the country's first four-year Islamic liberal arts college. And they are graduating their first class in May. Also with me in studio is Ilham Awad, a graduating student at San Francisco State University, also a member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, AROC. Her major is International Studies, and her minor is French. She is Sudanese American. And so Abbas is no longer with us, but he had a lot to say in the panels about gender relations and marriage, and that that the Muslim community kind of, that's one of the things that need to be worked on in terms of gender. And a lot of the stereotypes out there about Islam and Muslims have to do with gender, with women, with the place of women in society, that women are oppressed, that women, they have to bundle up in those burqas and be submissive to their husbands. And so let's dive into that a little bit. Ilham, with you, how have you had to deal with those kinds of questions about, well, you're Muslim? Well, isn't that an oppressive religion? And what are you doing in that religion?
Yeah, definitely had those questions. Luckily, the group of friends and the people that I've tried to associate with and interact with come from more open, have more open mentalities, and so they don't assume that. But definitely, people, they find out I'm, a Muslim woman, they're like, I don't know, how are you going to get married one day? You know what I mean? You're not allowed to date in Islam, right? Or you're not allowed to do this and that. And I don't know, do people tell you what you can and can't wear? And can you, so many different things. And I think that growing up, having to kind of maneuver through that, I tried to create a difference. I tried to create a separation between what people think, societally, and then what my faith says and what my culture, my Sudanese identity says, my Arab identity, my African identity. So I tried to take what I could from all of that, because in the end, my mom has always taught me that, in the end, you are your own woman, and you have to do the things that feel right for you, no matter what anybody says, because a lot of it is interpretation, the way people view gender roles. And so from my family or from my community, I've never felt, this intense oppression or anything. Definitely, I do see sometimes, at our events, for example, the men and women sometimes sit separately, depending on the occasion, things like that. And I personally feel that that's not how it has to be. And I think that the next generation, because we are balancing between different ideals, we're going to shift that. We're going to shift the gender roles for the next generation. But it's kind of funny sometimes when people, like, I grew up playing soccer, and I played in a league and everything. And I remember I would be fasting during my games. That was like my thing. Like, I'd be fasting because it was Ramadan, and I'd be playing soccer. And people first, when they'd find out I was fasting, they're like, oh my God, you're... how can you do that? You know, I feel so bad for you and things like that.
You haven't had anything to drink.
You haven't had anything to drink and everything. And a lot of it is mind over matter, you know. And I felt good about it. But then on the other end, they're like, oh, you play soccer? You play sports? Even my Muslim friends, you know, a lot of them, especially the guys, they're like, you played soccer? You play soccer? You know how to? Or you dance? You know what I mean? I'm in a Sudanese dance group. And I mean, so many different things that they think women don't do. And I see that as those people putting limitations
within
the community and outside the community, rather than actually listening to the women within the community who are like, we're challenging all of that. And we are, you know, participating in so many different things. Mm. And so, yeah, I think it comes from the external a lot more, too.
Daoud Waleed, we had a conversation before, you and I, about kind of the immigrant Muslims coming to America. My parents were immigrants. Ilham's parents were immigrants. Many, I think, of the Muslim community here has immigrant origin. But kind of those immigrant Muslims coming to America and finding Muslims here, native Muslims, you know, whether they're white or African Americans, and kind of feeling there's an upper hand. But at the same time, they feel that there's this uniquely American Islam that's coming out, that's kind of flavored and set here in America. And we can even kind of go deeper and say for the Bay Area, it's very uniquely also flavored.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that a little bit, being an African American Muslim and those kind of struggles between immigrant and native?
Yeah, I think you really hit the point when we were talking, because I really think what it comes down to is, in my opinion, a crisis of legitimacy and a crisis of authority. Because, you know, and it's interesting. I'll share a couple of points with you here. You know, one of the things I feel that you have also Muslims immigrating from countries that at times have had a strained political relationship with the U.S., right? We'll talk about that on the political level. So therefore, kind of, you know, you have America, the great Satan from, you know, the 80s, relationship Iranian rhetoric and in other areas as well too, where American foreign policy hasn't been at its most best relationship with those peoples, we'll say. So therefore it's looked at like kind of anything that's coming out of the West is one, anti-Islamic, and two, at best is skeptical, right? We're a bit skeptical about anything that would be coming out of there because of that. I think it's tainted by that. It's my own personal opinion and through experience. So personal, on a personal level, you know, I'm pushing back on a lot of that. I have four daughters, and I feel that, you know, just kind of along with what Ilham was saying, that our last daughter, we named her Hope, and we actually got a question. Someone asked my wife, asked my wife's niece, if we had left Islam.
Your daughter Hope?
Because we named our daughter Hope.
Not an Arabic name?
Exactly. Mm. Right? So again now, right, as if Hope has no meaning as to me as an American, right, who happens to be Muslim.
English speaking.
And I took it even further, and this was a debate that I lost with my wife, but I was going to name her Autumn. And that's her middle name. So her name's Hope Autumn Yassin. So the idea behind it, though, was to, one, you know, was to push back on this idea that she can be Hope and 100% Muslim and American. And anything else you want to add, you know, on to that. So that's just one little story that I wanted to share with you. I think, you know, with this other idea, though, is so, for example, I spent about 5 years in Damascus studying Islam and Arabic. I've taught Arabic. I've TA'd Arabic for years while I was at Yale. And I'm, you know, here. I've taught Arabic for 4 years in the summer Arabic intensive. Now I'm in a different role here. But my point is, you know, you find yourself in a position where, for others, foreign-born, kind of looking at you, questioning your ability, perhaps, right? How could you understand that? I'm Muslim, born Muslim. I don't understand these things. How could you possibly, understand them? Then I think it's also tainted from the history of the relationship that the Nation of Islam has had with Islam, you know, in the United States as well, too, specifically to the African-American community, which I find quite interesting because there seems to be, that crisis maybe is not spread out evenly, you know, when we deal with ethnicities that are American, right? So that's something, again, that I feel that the East is dealing with. And I just came back from from Saudi. I was there. I led a co-led a trip of 80 people. Most of them were students from some schools, from NYU and from Yale and from some of the SUNY schools in New York State University of New York. And you know, the question that you always get when someone asks you, "Well, where are you from?" and you tell them, "Well, I'm American," and they'll laugh.
Why would they laugh?
Because you're not what they in their mind have created as the right as the quintessential American, right? You're not blonde, you're not blue-eyed, you're not Anglo-Saxon, basically. Well, other than blonde and blue-eyed, but you're not Anglo-Saxon, right? As if that's the reality of America. So I think that's kind of their misreading, misunderstanding of what the reality of America is, and I think that gets then transferred into Islam as well, too.
I'd like to give the number out to our listeners if you have any questions or comments. If you have any questions for our panel, and if you were curious about your Muslim neighbors around you, here are some interesting facts that were laid out in the Bay Area Muslim Study. They surveyed over 1,000 Muslims who live in the Bay Area, and 41% are full-time employed. That's one statistic. Another one is that 62% of Bay Area Muslims reported volunteering in the past year. The national average is only 27%. Higher education, 78% South Asian community reported some college. So it's a highly educated community. It's a community that's making money also, specifically the South Asian community in Silicon Valley. Average household income for Muslims in the Bay Area is Bay Area Muslims, 70,000. United States average is 50,000. Higher education, 30% have a bachelor's degree, 25% have some grad school, 5% have a PhD. Just some numbers about Muslims in the Bay Area. The number to give us a call is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Ilham, if you can talk to us a little bit about that kind of that uniquely American flavor of Islam that we were just talking about. You guys, you're young, you were raised here, you went to school here. I was about to say born, but I know you weren't born here, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you also have this other Sudanese side, right? Your family's from Sudan, Muslims from Sudan. How are you different, for example, from your mom, from your dad? And what do you think your generation is doing to Islam here in America as you grow up?
I think the first difference, I would say, between me and my parents is that I went to school here from a young age. And so the kind of social interactions that I've had with this country and with, my community have been very different. And so because of that, inherently, I've been exposed to different things, and therefore I think about certain issues in a different way. For example, issues of race and issues of gender and class and things like that, the way I've seen them, I finally was able to contextualize it and to understand it better when I, you know, went to college, because my parents started finding out about all these different things that were happening to me and my sisters as kids, you know, talking about, you know, within the Black community, feeling like, do we fit in, you know, as African American, if we're African immigrants, because there is also a different life experience that we have had, and then within the Arab community, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I just, you know, when I talk about this country, for example, you know, my parents definitely played a large role in my political views and my critical view of things. But at the same time, I think we're accessing a lot more of that truth being in universities and being connected with so many people. And so when I talk about, you know, institutionalized racism, and I talk about, you know, the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex and things like that, all these things that I'm learning. And I know now it's so fresh in my mind because I'm in college. But and then I talk about, you know, sort of subtle racism that I've experienced growing up, or more explicit things like that. For my parents, there was a while where it was really hard to fully grasp all of that, because that wasn't fully their experience. They definitely did experience a lot of that. My mom said that she became, you know, she thought of herself as Black, you know, when she came to this country, you know, but before that it was different. My dad too. And for us, we were growing up, that's what we identified as, you know what I mean? You want to find a way to fit. I'm going to say I'm Black because I'm not, you know, all these different categories. I think they're very limited societally.
And for those who do wear the headscarf, because mm-hmm. it's just such a big, it's a big issue. It's very visible. Mm-hmm. When you're walking down the street, you can't tell who's a Muslim man. But mm-hmm. if there's a girl wearing a headscarf, you know she's Muslim.
Exactly.
So for your friends, for your family who do have the headscarf on, what do they say in terms of being in high school or being in middle school and dealing with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they definitely faced a lot of that. If it was discrimination, or if it was just confrontations in general, and I think they faced that a lot more. And because visibly they fit, you know, the stereotype. It's not just a stereotype. It's just based on how people connect with the faith, you know. And so that's what I see it as. It's a reflection of what you want to take from it, you know. And I do have cousins who wear the headscarf, and we interact in the exact same way with each other. We listen to the same music, you know, Western music. People are like, you know, sometimes are like, oh, you listen to, you know, yeah, we listen to a lot of that. We go to concerts, things like that, you know. And I think that we understand each other, but I know that their experience is different because they have this visible element to it. And so I think it's really complex. I think it's a very complex issue.
Dawood, you've said before that Muslim youth have been invisible. What does that mean?
What I meant by that was that, you know, we're talking about radicalization a lot of times. We talk about radicalization of the youth, and like, but we're never hearing anything, right? So if we're talking about a radicalized group, is it inherent? Or is it something that they have issues with? We'll say, I'm just taking that for example. Or I also meant from things which are positive as well too. I know some friends that are starting some amazing, the Smile Project in New Jersey, which is offering, you know, healthcare and you know, access to food for areas of, you know, non-Muslims as well as Muslims. The Ummah Clinic in L.A., friends of ours that were in Damascus, I remember that was born out of the living room in one of the conversations that we had. They were medical students, and they went back and formed this, and it's an award-winning clinic, a free clinic now, serving people. So, again, where are these stories at, right? We hear a lot about 30 and under and entrepreneurial and great achievements such as that. So that's when I talk about kind of being silent, you know, where is that? Or are they just kind of mixed in the fact that they're Muslim really is a non-issue at that point? You know, so that's really what I meant. But, Han, I wonder if I could just mention, just going back to the last point that we had, because there's something that I do feel is quite important to mention. You know, my wife and I remember one time we were in a store, and my wife wears a headscarf, and a woman came up to us. And, you know, God bless her heart. She said, look, she just approached us. We were in a store buying some clothes. And she said, my wife's parents are converts. So she was born Muslim, but her mother and father are converts, African American. Her mom's, you know, European American. And, the woman came up to us and said, I just want to let you know that I don't hate you. And I said, thank you so much. I don't hate you either. And she said, I know you really, you know, life in your countries are hard and you really struggle. And you've come here looking for a better life. And I said, no, ma'am, I was, you know, I was born here. And she just couldn't get it. She kept saying, no, I know, it's really difficult here. No, I said, I'm from here the first time. I said, I'm from here. She said, I know it's difficult, and, you know, thank God that we have this visa program that we have where you can, you're allowed to come into the country. And I said, no, I'm born here. And she's like, she still couldn't get it. I'm like, look, my mother was born here. My grandmother was born here. You know what I mean? We're talking like 1892, you know, my family has been here in the same place in Massachusetts. So when we're talking about that, and in other times, you know, I've been, you know, given the finger and told to go back to my country. I'm like, go back to my country. You know, great, we'll drop you off in Holland, and we'll drop you off in Italy, and we'll drop you off in Germany, and then I guess we'll go back to Cape Verde, and I'll get off there.
Ilham is snapping away in here in the studio. Let me just give out the number one more time. 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you'd like to ask our panelists a question, if you have a comment, or if you're Muslim and you're listening and you want to share your own experience about what it's like being a Muslim here in the Bay Area, here in the U.S., what you are dealing with and how you deal with it, you can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Ilham, you were snapping, but you also wanted to say something.
I mean, I think that's just like, I don't know, Dawood's like story is just the prime sort of example of the kind of ridiculous also. I mean, I know that people have good intentions, but it's kind of like these ridiculous sort of interactions you find yourself having with people, because it's like sometimes I see it as people wanting to have this sort of like self-righteous sort of like, you know, attitude about things, like, you know, I'm a progressive person, you know, and I've had that in college, you know, I was in a study group one time, and we were studying for our international relations final for one of my classes, and one of the girls I was working with, she's Jewish, and she always wants to talk about Palestine and Israel, and mm-hmm. she wants to let me know that I support both sides. She always wants to let me know that. And then I'm like, you know, I appreciate that, you know, and but then she always says things like, you know, oh my gosh, you're so progressive. You're such a progressive Muslim. You're such a, you know, you're so open, and I love that. And I'm like, I mean, well, what else would you expect me to be, you know? And so it's that's,
well, she expects you to be what she sees.
Well, she exactly,
right?
Exactly. And I think that for people who even engage, take the time to engage and you know, confront people or just approach them and say things, you know, I do give them the benefit of the doubt too, because it's like, you know, there is a lot of, there are a lot of lies out there. And for you to be able to kind of sift through that and be like, you know what, I'm not going to fully subscribe to that. I mean, I think I definitely commend that. But at the same time, you know, it just goes to show that these misconceptions, they happen in like the most subtle ways, but they represent such a big issue.
Is it getting better? Dawood, is it getting better?
Yeah, you know, I think it is. I think it is, because I think that also what's happening is that Muslims, to be honest with you, we're very, very insular, right? And I think that they're realizing now that they have to also be expressing who they are. Mm. You know, and I think this is something that's really important. I'll share this with you. I took that trip to Ohio. So I like to engage people in areas where they're not expecting it. So, for example, last year I organized a conference here. I was at Dartmouth, but I came out here, organized a conference on Islam and the environment. And it was really great. And we had a lot of people that were, you know, Rabbi, I'm sorry, Reverend Fletcher Harper and others from Green Faith, national organization, Christian organization, and others. But really, you know, Muslims are interested in the environment, climate change, you know, so one. But two, on a personal level, and I'll share this with you why I think it's changing, is so, you know, I'll say this in public, actually. So actually, I bow hunt, right? So I bow hunt, and it's something that I do in terms of, like, you know, how I engage halal, you know, in terms of food for myself and my family. So that puts me in a pretty interesting group of characters, right? So when I told you I was going to Ohio, I actually was driving with two men that were, one was an evangelical Christian, the other one was a staunch Catholic. And both of them could not stand Obama, you know, Republican, right wing. And here I am in the pickup truck with these guys, and we're driving, you know, 15 hours together. It's been
with
a conversation,
your bows and arrows.
With our bows and arrows, exactly. And the conversations, though, about religion, about politics, totally opposite ends of the spectrum. But yet we're able to engage with each other. That's what I'm hopeful of, that people will be able to get over the stereotypes and begin to engage people. And I feel that's what Elhanna's talking about right there. That's what I'm excited about. And that's what I do feel is changing.
Yeah. We only have a couple of minutes left, but final thoughts, Ilham. So you're graduating. What's going to be happening to you and with you in the next couple of years? And do you feel you want to play a role in correcting stereotypes, misconceptions, or do you feel that's really not my job?
I mean, I think that it is my job to do that. From personal experience and just from the communities that I'm a part of. And I agree with Daoud. I think it's really changing. And one of the things, you know, being here on the show, you know, media plays a large role in that. You know, we had talked about that on the panel, that there is one side of media that is corporate media. It's following a certain agenda, you know, with foreign policy and things like that. But then there are other mediums, you know what I mean, that are trying to challenge that. And I really want to be able to bring those marginalized voices to the forefront, because they are only marginalized because that's how society has treated them, but they're actually very strong voices, you know, and they're doing amazing things. So, I mean, in the next few years, I think I really want to plug in to that, looking at grad programs that encompass those sort of ideas and plugging in more with local organizations. And just for listeners out there, you know, and for people who, if this is your first time getting exposed to this topic and everything, I just think, you know, ask questions and, you know, connect with people.
To ask. Yeah. Thank you so much. Ilham Awad, also with us, was Daoud Waleed today. Thank you very much for being with us. Thanks to Abbas Darab as well. You can see the panels online at newamericamedia.org. I'm Hanna Baba. I was sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. This is Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss the media coverage of the deadly shooting at Fort Hood Military Base in Texas. How have the media shaped the narrative about war veterans, combat experience, and post-war mental health? We'll be joined by the Center for Investigative Reporting's Aaron Glantz and Military Times' Leo Shane. Where did you see the best reporting this week? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.